Yeah, when people ask, I say, oh, well, it starts in portraiture, and it just gets stranger from there. Not a lot of the work is made and remade within the studio space. All, you know, like everything that is in the work is tied to people, and is tied to those friendships.
Hi, I'm Dan Rubenstein, and this is The Grand Tourist. I've been a design journalist for nearly 20 years, and this is my personalized guided tour through the worlds of fashion, art, architecture, food, and travel, all the elements of a well-lived life. In a time when everyone has a camera in their pocket capable of things that would be unthinkable a decade ago, fine art photographers are reinventing what makes an image, sometimes shunning digital tools like Photoshop to create authentic and captivating art. I first saw the work of my guest today, Paul Mpaji Sapuya, at the Museum of Modern Art in New York in 2018. Sapuya, a California native based in Los Angeles, takes mostly matter-of-fact portraits and self-portraits. As the New York Times wrote about the MoMA show, black and gay, with an interest in investigating his racial and sexual identities, Mr. Sapuya uses collages and mirror shards to fragment the image. Quote, "There's a codedness," he said, describing his work. "I'm interested when someone can piece together another layer of meaning from a fragment of a body or the location of a room." Sometimes, Paul shoots self-portraits in the nude, alone or with others. Looking at his work, you feel slightly voyeuristic, but not in a crude way. Instead, you feel as if you're inhabiting the gaze of both the artist and the subject. The work is intimate, even when there's nothing in the frame other than his camera. Paul has shot for covers of magazines like Wallpaper and Vogue Ukraine, and his work has been collected by museums such as the Guggenheim and the Whitney. But before I speak about this rising star, I wanted to put his work into context. For that, I've turned to Courtney Willis Blair, partner at the New York Mega Gallery, Mitchell, Innes & Nash. Blair curated a group show this winter in Mexico City that Paul was a part of during the Zona Maco Art Fair. I wanted to ask her why Paul's work is so collectible and how this budding maestro fits into the current age of fine art photography. And stick around to the very end to hear Courtney discuss Entre Nous, her supper club for black women in the gallery world. It was just too fascinating to leave in the cutting room floor. I caught up with Courtney in Mexico City. And so I'm talking to you now while you happen to be in Mexico City. And this is, this show that has Paul in it is the first sort of entree into Mexico City for the gallery. Why Mexico City? Why now?
Well, you know, I've been coming to Mexico City for a little under a decade, about 9 or 10 years I've been coming here. And for me, Mexico City has been a fantastic city, not only to see art. You know, there's certainly a history of artists being here, you know, both Mexican artists and international artists. You have, you know, Elizabeth Catlett, Frances Elise is here, certainly Diego and Frida, who are sort of these, you know, legendary figures here, the muralist. All of that shows that there's a history, not just of their cultural institutions, right? Where you've got institutions like Tomeo and MUAC and even HUMEX, you know, some of these newer institutions that really create, I think, a really wonderful ecosystem. But also that it's a place where artists can come and they can thrive and they want to be here. And then in addition to that, it has an incredibly sophisticated class of collectors. And so I think all of those things together were sort of proven for us that it makes sense as sort of a critical outpost in a way, in the same way that New York is for the US, or, you know, Brussels or Paris or London is for Europe and the UK, as Hong Kong is for Asia. I think Mexico City is particularly critical on an international stage, but also for here in the region. And I can't complain about being in a city that has great food, has great art, has wonderful people and beautiful architecture.
And to pivot again a little bit in a somewhat, if I were to ask bluntly, like, why should a collector collect Paul's work? Why is Paul worth collecting? Mm-hmm. What would you say?
I think Paul is worth collecting for a number of reasons. I think when you are thinking about collecting, right, there's a couple of sort of tenets that I like to follow. And I think Paul really hits them. One is that, what are the aesthetics, right? Do you like what you are looking at? I mean, that is a really important part of it. You know, what's the story behind it? Right? What's the narrative around the piece in particular? How does it fit in with this artist's work across the board? And then again, as a sort of a larger conversation within contemporary photography or contemporary art. And I think Paul, as someone who has had really great exhibitions and a fantastic book published on the work, and essays, there's clearly a really wonderful narrative around the work. I think one of the other things is, you know, when you're buying work, and some people might not agree with me on this, but I think you're really investing in the artists themselves. And so really understanding the artist's ambitions, their sort of goals, their capabilities, what they've done in the past, what they're looking to do in the future is really important. And I think Paul is the real deal. He is someone who is constantly experimenting. He's constantly thinking about sort of how his works from, you know, a few years ago play into the works that he's making now. You know, something that he does, which I find really phenomenal, is that when he creates work, he doesn't immediately show it. He sits with it. He thinks about it. He creates, you know, a sort of constellation around works, which is why we're showing work from 2018, 2017, 2020, because it's not just, okay, this is my new body of work, but instead, this is the thing. These are the things that I've been thinking about. And to me, creating really a story in that way that sort of traverses time is something that I think is really phenomenal. So for me, Paul really hits these tenets that I think are important around as an artist, but also within the work itself.
And so tell me about this particular show and if you could help describe it in broad strokes.
Yeah. It's a show with three artists, Paul Mpagi Sapoya, Lucas Samaras, and Tiana Nikia McLaughlin. It is a show that's looking at how artists, primarily through photography, but not fully, are thinking about methods of masking or concealment to sort of expose or reveal something, something else, something new. And I think it's a really beautiful show. We're being hosted by Galleria Elario Galguera in San Rafael. The show closes on Thursday. So by the time this comes out, I think it will be closed. But we have some really great, we've got some really great installation shots, and it's been a really wonderful experience. But it includes, like I said, primarily photography, 1978 Polaroids by Lucas, which are in incredible condition. As well as a few of Paul's work from the Darkroom Mirror series and the Studio series, and then three pretty spectacular works by Tiana Nikia McLaughlin, a series of leather pieces, one of her leather belts, a pair of leather boots, as well as a work that is made up of 65 prints that she took over the course of 10 days, where she was really looking to reveal her fullest identity as a dom, a priestess of Santeria, and a visual artist.
And how does Paul's work fit into the show? If you could describe how he's included.
Sure. So actually the show started with Paul. I was in conversation with him. I've known Paul now. I've certainly known his work for a while. I was a docent at the Studio Museum in 2013. And at the time, he was sort of the resident photographer for all the artists in resident participants, as well as some of the curators. And so I've known his portrait photography for quite some time. And so we were in conversation around doing a show. You know, I had this idea to do something in Mexico City, and I wanted to work with him. And we were thinking about other artists that we thought would really complement the work. And as we were sort of going through lists and talking a bit more, Lucas's name came up really around this particular body of work that's being shown which were incredibly controversial at the time, because Lucas is actually sort of hiding in the shadows of all of the Polaroids. He is fully clothed, sort of creeping out of the shadows, while his subjects, who are fully nude, are sort of front and center. And so there was really this wonderful relationship between how Paul was employing lovers and friends, other artists, other creatives in his community, and Lucas was doing the same, and really thinking about these ideas around concealment. And at the same time, I was actually working with Tiana on something else and had seen some of these works and realized pretty quickly that the three of them together, that there was this really sort of strong premise around these ideas of masking or concealment. And but really, Paul, I think, he was the impetus for the show, his work.
And if you had to explain to someone off the street, you know, who Paul is and describe him and his work, how would you do that?
Well, you know, let's see, how would I do that? So Paul is a young artist. He's in his late 30s, originally from California, where he continues to live and work. He's in LA now. He's a formalist, you know, at heart. He has a dedication to staging, lighting, composition, subject, you know, all of these things, technique, his own tools. He has an incredible knowledge of the history of photography and references it in a way that's both elegant but poignant. And I think that the thing that sort of sets Paul apart within this sort of formal apparatus, right, to create his work, is that he's really thinking through a conceptual bent that allows for the work to take on, you know, several different meanings. And so as he's thinking about how he turns the camera on us, right, on the viewer, how he sort of reveals the things that are oftentimes behind the scenes or put into the shadows or not supposed to sort of be focused on or centered, really begins to speak to ideas around sort of what spaces are public and private, right? Not only intimacy, but also for safety. And I think about facility. I think about queer facility. I think about, you know, his relationship with the nude, but also his relationship with sort of queer theory around the figure. And so for me, these sort of confrontational themes that he's dealing with are done in such a soft and elegant way that there's sort of a quietude to the work. While also really, you know, without sort of turning away from some of these heavier conversations.
Before we return to the program, a word from our sponsor, Fort Street Studio. Fort Street Studio's sumptuous carpets are expertly hand-knotted and executed in nuanced color combinations that are the signature of the studio's painterly designs, which originate from watercolor art. The brand services a global clientele from its flagship showroom in Manhattan, where their team of specialists guide interior designers, architects, and collectors through the studio's offerings. The legendary outfit has an extensive catalog where each design can be customized endlessly, but they also carry stock carpets in standard sizes. As the offerings of Fort Street Studio are so expertly hand-knotted, photos rarely do these works of art justice. That's why an in-person consultation is so key. Only then can the subtleties of rug design and its colors truly come to life. To book your own consultation, visit fortstreetstudio.com. I normally speak with artists and other talents on this podcast at a later stage in their storied careers. That's why it was so interesting to speak with Paul, an artist whose career is evolving in real time. In other words, I'm catching him on the upswing. As an artist entrenched in the contemporary art world, I wanted to ask him about the things he probably doesn't speak about often: his life, the origins of his creativity, and what it all means to him. What were you like as a kid? I'm curious. Like, were your parents, you know, fostering your creative talent in any way? Or was it, like, what was that? How would you describe, you know, a teenage Paul?
Oh my God, my teenage self. Well, I will say that I feel very fortunate that my mom always supported, you know, whatever I was doing. You know, drawing and painting as a kid, you know, later on in middle school or the beginning of high school, she gave me one of her, this camera that she had had since she took like a photo class in college. And all, oh my God, all the like bizarre gay stuff I was doing as a teenager.
What was the most bizarre gay thing you did as a teen?
Oh, I mean, it was like the 90s in California. I don't know. I was a pretty good kid. I wasn't really pushing boundaries in terms of like partying and things like that. But, you know, I had red and blue and pink hair and my, you know, and some piercings and, oh, what was it? If I could piece together some of those, like, kind of like that very Southern California verge of like rave, rockabilly, and goth all sort of mixed together. You know, me and my London Underground creepers and like spike chain necklaces and, you know, my friends hanging out. There's really nothing much to do. I mean, San Bernardino had a big rave scene. But we were really bored and would spend a lot of time just like in coming into LA and hanging out in Silver Lake and Hollywood and Santa Monica and places like that. So yeah, anyways, and I was making a lot of really tacky, bad gay paintings that time. And then also just like playing around with photography. Oh God. Yeah. I can't believe I'm talking about this stuff. I mean, my close friends know about this stuff, but I'm like, I'm telling this on a podcast.
Did you keep any of them? The paintings?
Absolutely not. My mom has a bunch of them. My best friend from high school, Kelly, who lives out there in Redlands, has a bunch, and she's like, if you ever go back to painting. She's like, I want them. Like all her family members, like that I'm friends with, are like, I want a Paul painting.
And were you out at the time? Like when you were, you know, like had a spiked collar and you had multicolored hair and like, you know, like what was that sort of? We're somewhat the same age. You're a little bit younger than I am, but that was a kind of a unusual early time to be out, even if you were kind of out without being out, if that makes any sense.
To back up there, I was probably on the internet from almost the very beginning, since grade school in the 80s. We had like a really intensive and kind of amazing computer program. And before I wanted to be an artist, or knew that that was something that I could do, I wanted to be in computers. And so I was programming and like building computers and all of this stuff like since fourth grade or something. So by the end, you know, I convinced my mom to let, you know, to get us, you know, computers. So I was on the internet and in chat rooms since the MS-DOS days on Prodigy. Mm-hmm. And then
Prodigy.
Yeah. And then, you know, when Windows came around, you know, CompuServe. And yeah, I guess in that sense, I was very precocious, for better or worse. So I, you know, and I was really exploring kind of like everything on the internet, from message boards to like those early web rings. And so that was a space into which I was probably or definitely was out, so to speak, since I was maybe 12 and unbeknownst to I don't know. I feel like when you're a kid and you're on the family computer, like even though it may be in another room in the office, like they know what's going on. And I think, yeah, definitely like my brother, who's a year younger than me, like was always like, what are you doing on the computer? So, you know, I was involved in like gay internet, like teen projects as like in middle school. There was this online magazine called Oasis that I had a column for at maybe 13, 14, like a lot of like now you would say queer kids were generating, you know, making our own sort of like content for it. And it would be, you know, there were, you know, kids who were very isolated and closeted in certain places. There were kids who were like out and like fabulous. There were like people like, you know, just negotiating everything in between like that kids would have. So I was out on there and like with internet friends and all of this stuff. And then I came out in middle school. I didn't think it was in eighth grade. I went to a non-religious private grade school in middle school. And then I was about to go to, I was going to go to a Catholic high school. And so I remember coming out and then mom was like, oh, do you still want to go to this school, St. Thomas Aquinas? And like my one friend was going to go there. my one good friend from growing up that was in my grade was going to go there. So I was like, I still want to go. And yeah.
And how did you go from there to sort of studying art? Like what sort of inspired you to go to, you went to Tisch, correct? In NYU. So you had to sort of cross the country and that's a long way to go for someone who's, you know, 18 or however old you were at the time.
Yeah, I started NYU when I was 17. I wasn't even 18 yet. Yeah, it's like, why did that even happen? I think through the early internet, and I guess this is, sorry, I mentioned kind of like thinking about how, you know, art, tying it into art making, but there was something, and this is also something that I've talked about in other, like in artist talks mm-hmm. and things in terms of like references, but there was something about like now it's so easy to find exactly what you want, or there are so many kind of like niche things that I think of it kind of like a Times Square red, Times Square blue, sort of like Delaney thing. Like the internet was kind of like that bar that he talks about, that it's like, you know, before search engines, or when the only thing was sort of like altavista.com and you would be like gay, or you would find a web ring, like you would sort of stumble into all of this, into like a gay internet, a queer internet. And yes, there were like very, you know, you could find your way into very specific kind of like subcultures or fetishes or whatever. But there's this way in which like the gay internet was less like gay content being made, like in terms of like visual images. I'm not necessarily talking about like pornography that was sort of being, you know, early digital images or things that were being scanned and uploaded. But like it was more about like what out there could be aggregated in these fan pages that then made it gay. Like gay was kind of like how you used it. It would be like everything from clips from daytime TV to like, you know, fashion and like perfume, you know, or like cologne ads to, you know, sports to, you know, it was just kind of like. And then, you know, in that mix, of course, you know, people were beginning to like scan and digitize like, you know, like gay porn, like print publications. And then you had all these like emerging, you know, platforms. But there was this. And then, of course, I discovered a lot of art through that I didn't even know was art. And, you know, years later, realizing that some artists who now I know and, both, you know of, but also feel fortunate to know that my first encounters with their work were just through trying to find, you know, exciting, titillating, pornographic things as a teenager, that there's this sense in which I find it very valuable to not have distinctions between sort of like high and low when it comes to references and inspiration. So anyways, just to say is through all of that stuff, I got really into all kinds of print and online media and publications, stuff like that. And I just became, I was like a obsessive magazine collector. And so many of the things that I fell in love with were coming out of New York. And so, you know, and I was just, maybe because LA was so close and I never felt like super, you know, there was something like alluring about New York being really far away.
Which magazines were you addicted to?
Well, I would say the one that made me want to, the two that made me want to move to New York as a teenager were Interview Magazine and Vibe Magazine in the 90s. And then, you know, just, it's so interesting to be like, oh, I was a teenager obsessed with like Andy Warhol and like The Factory. And then, you know, the work of like David LaChapelle and all these things. So I was just collecting tons of magazines and kind of falling in love with this idea of New York. But I took a photo. I took like a photo class at the University of California at Riverside. It was maybe my sophomore year of high school, maybe sophomore, junior year in that program. And that's a kind of a long story of why I took that class. From there, I found out, oh, you can go to school for this. And I was like, I'm going to go to NYU.
And do you remember, was there a point, you know, after grad school where your work, where you hit sort of like a flashpoint where we would now recognize it in the work that we see now, right? In your current work, was there a moment where something clicked and you kind of found a technique or a look or something that, you know, would be more recognizable today as your work, as people now know it, if that makes any sense?
Yeah. That would be the project that I kind of began with, that UCLA thesis project. I feel like there's still so many, in some ways, complicated feelings around that, because when I was talking about the work that I kind of, or the fragments of work and these histories of friendships that I sort of brought into the studio and started working through, let's say in that Hyde Park Art Center residency, some of that began in the Studio Museum, but there was, you know, that move. Like, I came back to LA and I started making these images in my studio as a way to kind of, in a sense, process. We're all processing. It's the 21st century, so all we do is process. I was processing like all of this time, and in a sense, like, sense of failure, but also the sense of continuity. That's the fragments that you would see in those initial images, the ones that were more sort of like geometric. And this is the stuff that was prior to the thesis project. Because the studio from the Studio Museum in Harlem residency and the Hyde Park Art Center residency had become a backdrop into which I was making portraits of people, and it became a recurring sort of space. In the absence of having people come into my studio to photograph, but me photographing the fragments, I began using these mirrors as a way to then reflect myself at times back in there, but to reflect the studio. You know, I guess it's hard to describe in a podcast, but if someone looks up those images, you'll see that there's these floating fragments in a sense, and then you see the camera reflected and you see the wall of my studio behind it, and sometimes you see me, maybe my hand is reaching in, sometimes I'm a blur because it's a long exposure, sometimes I'm completely obscured by the material. And that work got really, really well known, and I had, you know, and some of it was getting shown in New York. It's like, I feel like I'd lived so long in New York, and I'd always wanted a big show in New York. I was really grateful for these really amazing shows in Minneapolis and Vancouver and places, also Rhodes College in Memphis. But when I left, suddenly I had big shows in, you know, and that work was getting really well known in New York. And then when I had the thesis, I had like a show that kind of like brought all of that together. And so when I'm talking about the complicated feelings is, you live in a place for so long and the work was, you know, I lived there for so long. The content of the work and how I understand the work to be read and who was the intended audience for deciphering it, not just looking at it in the formal sense. So I was interested in making work that read that formally is very sort of like, in a sense, beautiful, but also like intriguing, that makes people want to know more, but also that it's the decoding of the content is only for people who are a degree or two away from it. That's the intended sort of like reader. That work was getting really well known. And I had this show in 2017 and I was meeting all these people. I was like, I know you. I was like, we've known each other for years, but now you are paying attention to me. And I was having this new kind of like biography written for me of, this is my first show. This is work that just sort of like is generated through, and I'm always very skeptical of kind of like witty or overthought artwork, like that someone sits down and kind of like thinks about what are the like the things that are just going to pull the right strings and then execute it. Like all of this stuff I'm very adamant on comes from a lot of in between time, of boredom, of failure, of like returning to things that like I didn't sit down and map out something to look really cool and then just execute them. Nor did the content just become generated within, you know, the year or so of making this work. So when first of all, that 2017 show was being contextualized as my first show in New York, or that this, that I was a new artist, it's like, no, it's, even though this is the first time that there was some sort of success in term, like I had never sold work through galleries before. But I thought it was also important to not erase the fact that that was my 11th solo show. Mm-hmm. I was very adamant on saying like, I'm not going to erase the Bushwick project shows, like the apartment galleries that friends put together, like the things that happened elsewhere. And also that, and to not erase the fact that like all of the elements that people were seeing and really interested in that work, I was like, in order to understand it, you have to see all of the elements that came before, because the thing that you're seeing in that project Figures Ground Studies has its, you know, its sort of first like real articulation in studio work. And then some of the fabrics and materials that you're seeing in there are actually pulling from those very first bedroom portraits. And it's, you know, and it's important for me to take those, literally those fabrics that, you know, that became imbued with so much just sort of like personal history. And, you know, and they're also, they become a recurring sort of like grounding in those initial portraits, that what happens to them when then they went to the studio. And then so when you're seeing the fabrics in those works that were getting out there, for me, it's a direct line through. So it was really, in that moment, I had to really figure out how to contextualize and shape the discussion, because I think part of what the art world wants when something kind of gets well known in like a broader sense for the first time is all the press around it, all of the like buzz, everyone wants it to be new. And I was in the same way, as maybe going back to the thing about the thing with sometimes with like with commercial work, is like I'm always insisting that nothing is new and that everything is reliant and dependent on, you know, many layers of that develop and accumulate and inform each other. So yeah, 2017 is when people would start to recognize what is sort of like more recognizable. And then that's, but by the time that show happened, I was already on to new work, this larger kind of like ongoing body of work, the darkroom work. And then through various other shows at Team Bungalow here in LA, and then at the New Museum Triennial Trigger, and a show at Document in Chicago, Darkroom, like then that work started getting out, and that's kind of where we're at now.
So a big part of your work is your own studio and the friends and collaborators that appear in the work. and it's a kind of intimate world building. Tell me a little bit about these subjects and what that relationship is like with them.
Yeah, I've never really liked photographing models. And I think that was even before I knew what I was doing. You know, by 2005, I was like, I only really want to make photos, make work with people that I know. And then also people, because I think of models as interchangeable, or where there is, after the image is produced, there's like a decoupling of like ongoing kind of like mutual interest or responsibility or feedback within the work. You know, it's just kind of like, oh, okay, showed up, did my thing and left. But with friendships, you know, and there's always going to be, you know, there's been times when there's, you know, been work made and people move and you lose touch, but then, you know, you reconnect like 5 years later or something like that. So it's not, I'm not saying that like within every image, it's like, this person is my best friend who's having dinner with like every week. But that in the sense that there's continuity, because I'm always most interested when and excited by the ongoing conversations around the work. I love, yeah, in that sense, I'm very like sentimental or nostalgic. There's, you know, more traditional portraits, you know, a portrait as a starting point for something. And then through what sort of gets set up or moved around or how the space might change, there are several kinds of images that have, that maybe the, it becomes sort of a bit of a repertoire that has developed over time out of a lot of like just accidental things happening, unplanned things, or just, you know, an observation caught off guard. That's like, oh, structuring an image like this could be, what would that look like? And then maybe I'm just sort of like figuring that out myself. And then, you know, and then a friend asks, how does that work? And then I show it to them and then they say, oh, I want to be in this. You know, this is literally how the Darkroom project started. And I've also talked about this before. It's like, I had been figuring out those works that were made in this closed space between the mirror surface and the black velvet. And I was in that space with my camera using myself and the black velvet to make visible all the smudges and the traces on the mirror that were the result of doing the sort of mirror collages, or let's say a body pressed up against them. And I hadn't thought about that space in terms of like what sort of like playful and unexpected thing that could happen, merging the language around the queer darkroom with the dark room and the dark cloth that I had set up just in order to photograph that surface. So when a friend asked if he could be in the picture with me, and I was like, I don't know if this is going to work. Out of all the pictures, none of them really worked. But there was one where I'm inside and he's pulling back the velvet. And suddenly that established, oh, there's a space where we can think about the outside, the inside, this idea of, okay, now we can really think about it as kind of like cruising across the surface. What does it mean for there to be an enclosed loop where voyeurism and exhibitionism are like kind of collapsed into a single image that's presenting something, that's presenting a resulting image for an outside viewer who is both implicated in it by this apparatus directed at them, but in reality, completely excluded. So it's sort of this thing where it kind of wraps all these things in together, but that wasn't, that just, that comes from a result of like, you know, the coincidences of a conversation and just figuring out something in the moment and then stepping back and thinking about the images. And then that created a space. So now, you know, you have various things. There's the traditional portraits, there's the darkroom mirror portraits, there's ones called figures, there's ones called model studies where there's a certain kind of like posture or gesture where I'm interested in a portrait not becoming a portrait and a person kind of becoming a type. And then there's so many things. There's orifices and apertures, which are just photographing the studio across these cuts. There's the screens where there's the trans, you know, there's all these things. So I guess what I'm saying is, everything starts with portraiture, but then sometimes in conversation, with a friend in the studio, we're like, oh, this thing was interesting. Let's use that as a starting point and let's just make some things with the screens. Or I'm doing these ones where they're not made through a mirror, but you are just sort of seeing, you're unable to see the reflected surface into which friends are looking and making images, you know? So that's something that I'm currently working. There's all these various types of pictures in the works. I hope that answers that.
And like, what is there something about that sort of voyeuristic sense of the viewer getting to look into sort of like this private feeling, sort of like a private view of a queer world in a sense of like intimate moments that maybe in the past were not necessarily captured, they were edited out. And it's almost like in maybe in queer art in the past. Is that fair to say? Is that kind of a part of it in a way?
Sort. I mean, the one way I think that is interesting is, so there was a group show at the Getty, and I think it must have been in 2019, early 2020, because I think it was definitely pre-COVID. It was a show that was just a history of the camera as an apparatus, of artists making work that modifies that, or there's a lot of images of self-portraits reflection, or people imaging photographers make, you know. And that could be a space where queerness or race or all these things are not really, don't have to be part of the conversation. But I loved that they put my work in that show. And so what it does forces into a conversation that might not be about these things, having to contend with queerness, with performance of sexuality, with sort of the material and also social qualities of race as it is visualized in photography. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, yes, I'm interested in how, in what these images make visible, but I've never really been concerned with them as having a primary agenda of representing queer sexuality or representing or defining any particular social aspects of race. That makes sense.
Do you think people are trying to attach that to you in a way?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like, you know, and not to like, I think that, you know, there's been so many really great shows and contextualizings of the work. But I guess what I'm saying is like, I've never made a body of work, or my first agenda for having the work shown in a place that's like, this is, you know, the first approach is about representing queer people. And there's always the primary intent of the artist. And then there's the secondary and tertiary, like things that it intersects with. And we have to be able to talk about and contend with and be responsible to all those things. So I'm not talking about like an abdication of responsibility on those. And I can very much talk about all those things. For example, not all the people in the work are queer. Not all, you can't identify the gender, let's say, of any particular person in the work just through the photograph. You may not even race, in a sense, in some of an interesting segment of the subjects is misread. The resulting images or the text accompanying that does not explain it. I find all of that very, very interesting. I'm really into misreading. And so the thing that I'm aiming for is this is how the formation and the structure of the medium of photography, the layers of transparency and reflection, of obscuring, of making visible, are inseparable from how we understand or inseparable, I think, materially and formally from a reliance on blackness as a material. And this is, and not even getting into the social definitions of it, but just saying what happens when you acknowledge that like blackness, that black as a component for the image is required for the visibility of these traces. And what happens when you say, okay, the way in which queerness allows for this kind of like coexisting layers of relations and a kind of like multiple possibilities for performance of sexuality or gender is in a way inseparable from thinking about why and how photographs exist, that all of this is about a sense of like productive desire. Like that, those are the things that I'm interested in. So it's when this work can then infiltrate like spaces or curatorial ideas that are not about, like, there's this show that's up at Whitechapel in London right now that's just 100 years of the artist studio. Then you have these four works that are inserting into that, you know, it's four works where you see two black subjects like alternating between being on opposite sides of this mobile flat, either being able to sort of like interact or only see each other through their reflections and apart and then together, that it's kind of like, oh, okay, how do we think, you know, how do we get to thinking about the studio space as a framework that has to include these things? You know, I find that work much more interesting in that context than if it was just a show about like, here are images of black people, and now we can sort of start to lay claim to understanding contemporary, you know, black American social conditions.
And when you mentioned desire, there's a very popular photo of you that's just a self-portrait. It's just you, you're naked, you're kind of turning around. I'm forgetting the title of it, if it was a titled work. Was there any, you've put yourself into your own work and done self-portraits in the past, going back to, I think, the studio museum show.
Since 2005, 2004.
And is there any, like how do you, what is it like for you just to capture yourself alone? Is it a different mode? Like, how does that feel to the people who are out there that maybe, you know, they're not artists and they don't really do this kind of thing? Does it take you longer? Are you more critical of when it's just you, especially if you're naked and you're in this very vulnerable position? What is that like?
That one, oh, I know which one you're talking about. That was a couple of these pictures that I was making, thinking about these Rotimi Fanny Coyote images, White Feet, and then these like minor white photographs, also titled White Feet. They're incredibly uncomfortable. I mean, just like
physically or emotionally?
Physically, it's like things that, I guess that's one thing we can talk about, like models. You know, I'm sure models will be like, oh, this picture looked so elegant and effortlessly, but it's to try photographing yourself contorted, completely twisting around, because the way, you know, the images are not just like haphazard. It's like the formal construction of them is like everything needs to be lined up, you know, nothing sort of like askew. So it's incredibly difficult to make those pictures. In that sense, like there's sort of like two things happening. You just kind of like have to try to get the picture, and then it's like, and it's incredibly not comfortable and like not feeling like sexy in any way, you know. And then you just have to pick the picture that got the thing, you know. It doesn't feel really any different than portraits of other people. You know, like of the rare time that I have in the studio, most of it is just me by my, like, if it is time that's just me there, when I have an opportunity to make work, it's mostly just me moving things around, taking images of the space. Then occasionally I'll jump in and I'll like move things around or figure things out, you know. And then it's much more rare when I have, you know, and in chunks of time when I'm making images with other people. But whether it's my own self-portraits or making photographs with friends, you know, I send my friends the contact sheets of everything, so they can be like, oh, I don't like this, or I really love this. You know,
give them a sense, you sense of control, essentially.
Yeah, yeah, or a sense of just kind of like, you know, and it usually, it's very rare when a friend is like, I really don't like this and this and this picture, but I would, you know, I think last year there was one friend who was like, oh, I don't like how I look in these. And I was like, it's totally fine. Like, I'll just X those, and those aren't one, and those are ones that I won't kind of like consider using sort of like going forward. How do people like feel agency about like how they look in the pictures? Like, oh, do I look good or something? You know, so I want people to feel good. There's no reason to like use the picture where people feel most uncomfortable. That would be just cruel. Yeah, I did have a studio visit with someone, an artist whose work I really like, who's, yeah, told me that I'm too kind to my subjects, but their work kind of like taps into a much darker place.
And tell me a little bit about the show in Mexico City with Mitchell Ennis Nash and how that came about.
Yeah, I had been in touch, like Courtney and I had just been in touch. And, you know, she asked if I would be interested in doing a project together. And they were thinking about a space in Mexico City. And I said, sure. And I wanted it to really be like a interesting sort of like project space, sort of. And so the initial idea was to do a two-person thing. And she asked about, you know, if there are names of artists that, you know, be interested in doing a side-by-side. And I thought about Lucas Samaras, and for many reasons. I mean, that work is just amazing, and it's always a reference point. The images, you don't see images in the show from this, but like what I'm currently working on towards a show this fall at Vielmetter, I'm using darkroom lights and shooting at night. So with this colored light for the first time. And so I'd been thinking about Samaras, but the structure of Samaras's work kind of goes back to all of the prior images. I love these ones where he's on the edge of the frame, where he's inserting himself alongside his friends who are coming through. I love the way in which you're pulled back enough that the subject isn't isolated in a way that makes the resulting image mysterious, as you see the structure of the lights, you see the space that this is all in. And she was like, sure, I'll reach out and see. And the folks at his gallery were into it. And they were just like keeping the conversation open. And then it was going to be announced that they were going to start working representing Tiana. And so she was like, I think all of this would really work together. And I was like, that sounds amazing. And so it's one of these amazing group shows where I feel like all of the work, like all of the three of us, our works all together really informed and transformed each other, you know, like thinking about like the material, like the black leather and the sculptures of Tiana's work, and the hood that she's wearing in that Se Subo El Santo, you know, large piece, the way that like pulls into like the glossy black of the camera and tripod in my images, or, you know, and thinking about like the glance, there's like a diptych of me and a friend, and we're sort of, you know, both in across the frame, kind of like glancing, like there's, you know, kind of like sets up these really interesting things between what's happening there. And then the studio space mine, and then the studio, the way the studio space is in the Samaras works. That is just like a really great show. That's how it came together.
What would you say if you wanted someone, if there was one thing you wanted someone to know about your work as like the takeaway when they come to a show of yours, what would you want that one thing to be?
Oh, that's a really hard question, but it's a really good one. First thought is that like everything is there. None of them are tricky pictures, as confusing as they may look sometimes. That nothing is hidden as to how they are made. it may take a while to decipher them. It's also funny because after time, sometimes as things have moved around my studio, like I might go back to an image and say, where was I placed? What, you know, sometimes it takes a while for me to decipher how elements are being come together in the single frame, but that everything is there. What was there? There's no digital constructions or manipulations or post editing of things. Nothing is posing. And I think that kind of like holds everything. Yeah. You're looking at, even in the pictures where you don't see me or another person, like we were physically in that space. Or when you're setting it up, you can't see the setup without being in the image. And then yes, you can set the camera on a timer, or I can use the remote and then step away and take the image. But that in constructing it, that I'm always in the image. That's not the same thing when you're just working through digital space.
Thank you to Paul, Courtney, and the teams at Cultural Council and Mitchell Innes and Nash for making this episode happen. And stick around to the very end to hear about Courtney's group, Entre Nous. The editor of The Grand Tourist is Stan Hall. To keep this going, please follow me on Instagram at Dan Rubenstein to learn more. And sign up with your email for updates at thegrandtourist.net. And don't forget to follow The Grand Tourist on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. And leave us a rating or comment. Every little bit helps. Till next time.
And can you tell me a little bit about Entre Nous and what that is?
Sure. That's a pivot. So Entre Nous is it's a supper club that I began in late 2016, where I invited a number of Black women who worked at galleries in New York or had private advisories and also sort of auction house relationships as well, to just come together, to come break bread, let's talk, you know, nothing incredibly formal. There was never any mission statement, but it was really just a way for us to recognize that we were here. At the time, I could count the members of the group on two hands. We have since expanded and more than doubled, which is really fantastic. We're not only in New York anymore, we're also in San Francisco, Los Angeles, Switzerland, London. So we've gone global. And it really is looking at, it's really a way for Black women who are working in the contemporary art market to get together and to create relationships that are personal, that are professional, and to, as really sort of a support system. For a long time, there were so few of us, and, you know, not all of us knew who the others were, although we might have seen each other at openings for events, or, you know, in other areas. And so this sort of deliberate coming together allowed for a lot of really new connections and networks to happen. I mean, I always sort of I reference two sort of things that happened in 2017 that made me realize pretty quickly that not only was this group important, but it was successful. And those two things, one was that two members of the group ended up like going on vacation together, traveling to Berlin and having a great time. And I was like, okay, great. Friendships have evolved in the way that they needed to evolve. And the other was that two of the members of the group actually did a deal in which one of the gallerists, that was her biggest deal for the year and set her as the top earner for her gallery. And so these sorts of things that might not have happened before, but are absolutely sort of available to us, I thought was really important to be deliberate about, right? To find a way that we can sort of access the very things that we were deserving of and that we were capable of doing.
And when you guys are speaking about this sort of moment in art, right? Well, not necessarily, you know, photography per se, but just contemporary art in general, and the moment that we're in, from that point of view, like, what are some of the common things that require a support network,
yeah,
if you will?
Well, you know what I think is really important about Entrenew is how, you know, the conversations that we have are particularly, you know, they can get really, basically what I'm trying to say is, like, we're not a homogenous group, right? There's certainly commonalities between us. But, you know, I think of someone like Alexis, who has been working in the art world for, you know, 30 years and has seen a lot and has the kind of experience and wisdom that, you know, some of the women who have been working in the art world for less than 5 years really sort of look up to. But it also allows for us to have conversations where, you know, someone might have an opinion about something in one way and someone might have an opinion in another way. And we've always been incredibly respectful. We have incredibly sort of poignant conversations around the state of contemporary art, around the market, around the ecosystem, the things that are sort of set up, you know, radical care we talk about, we discuss, you know, things going to auction quickly, all of these sorts of topics.
What is radical care, if you don't mind me asking?
Oh, radical care. So radical care is the idea that in professional structures or professional relationships, that there can be a level of care that allows for that still allows for sort of success to happen, right? That it does not require sort of a coldness or a flippancy towards sort of people and their work, but also what they're going through. And so having a sort of a really particular level of empathy that allows, but also communication, transparency, trust. These, you know, I've been thinking about bell hooks a lot, of course, after her death, and her book All About Love, where she actually speaks about love not just through romantic relationships, but through sort of every relationship you have in your life, whether it is with colleagues at work, whether it's with clients, whether it's with familial relationships, friendships, all of these things. What does it look like if we sort of center this level of care as we build and develop relationships in the world? And so these are conversations that we are having, ways to think about how the market has failed, right?
How has the market failed?
The market has failed often. you know, the market is not always right, you know, and that's everything. Not everything is always right. And so there are certainly, you know, instances in which people are looking with their ears, right? Or they're buying because of what they think other people are buying, and there's frenzy around certain artists that you know, 5 years later, it's very hard to hold the value or what the market is considering the value. You know, it's a tricky and complicated conversation, because it also requires us to look at, like, who are the gatekeepers, right? Who is saying that this thing has value and who is saying that it doesn't? You know, what is, you know, if you look at, you know, for example, Warhol's market, right? You know, that's a very particular market. And Warhol has, for a very long time, been considered the most important artist of, you know, within contemporary art. But the market is not, it's because the art world is not a regulated market. Things are regulated in other ways. And so I think, you know, the market is not it's not without its faults. And there are certainly players that are more influential than others. There are certainly players that are more sinister than others. And all of these things can impact an artist's career, for better or for worse.